Yeah, welcome to you and good morning, everybody. I'm real pleased to speak to you today, and I'd like to thank the organizers for asking me to come present our work.
But I didn't introduce you.
Oh, Dan just kind of did.
I just introduced you.
It's okay.
Oh.
He knows. Elaine Berry, U.S. Meat Animals Research Center, Clay Center, Nebraska. Now I've lost the down button. There we go. Now, historically, foodborne disease outbreaks have been most commonly linked to animal products like, you know, meat and poultry and eggs and dairy and things like that. And outbreaks are still commonly associated to those products, but what, you know, the dynamic has changed a lot, and produce-associated foodborne illness outbreaks have become more common. Now, among foods for which, you know, the food source could be identified, produce-linked outbreaks increased from about 0.7% in the 1970s up to 8% in the 2000s. Now, fresh produce is produce consumed raw, and antimicrobial washes and other mild treatments are used to clean and decontaminate fresh produce, but their limitations depend upon the particular product because the acceptable quality characteristics need to be retained. Leafy greens are a particular challenge, because they are so fragile. And so protecting them from contamination in the pre-harvest production environment is very critical. And it's also a big challenge because there's so many potential sources of pathogens that contaminate fresh produce. Now, in 2006, there were three large outbreaks of foodborne illness due to E. coli 157H7 contamination in leafy greens and lettuce and then spinach primarily, that were grown in California. And after this happened, California farmers came together and they formed the Leafy Green Products Marketing, or Handlers Marketing Association. It's called the LGMA for short. And in collaboration with packers, processors, food safety scientists, they developed a document that provides food safety guidelines for the production and harvest of fresh produce. And amongst a whole bunch of different site-specific production guidelines for growing leafy greens, the LGMA suggests that there be a setback distance or a buffer zone distance of 400 feet be placed between concentrated animal feeding operations and the edge of leafy green crops. But it also admits that there's not a lot of scientific data that supports this particular distance. And because animals are a real important source of pathogens for the contamination of fresh produce, and one of the critical questions produce growers have is, what are appropriate distances that we can put in between our crops and livestock production to reduce the risk of produce contamination? That was the overall goal of our work, was to determine, was to provide information for setting appropriate setback distances. And our objectives were to, number one, determine the impact of proximity to a cattle feedlot on the prevalence of E. coli 157H7 in a target leafy green crop. Number two, we wanted to determine if E. coli 157H7 can be transferred as a bioaerosol on dust or by the wind from cattle production into a leafy green crop. And if this does occur, what are the environmental conditions that govern it, and how far can it be transported? And number three, we also wanted to determine what the impact of proximity to a cattle feedlot was on the occurrence of E. coli 157H7 positive flies in a leafy green crop. And I'm going to talk about each of these three items separately. I'm going to explain our approach and then what we found. I'll talk first about our experimental design, though. This is a Google Earth photo of our experimental site. So in each of 2 years, we planted 9 plots of leafy greens in our feedlot, just in a field just north of our feedlot at the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center, 3 plots each at 200, 400, and 600 feet. We have prevailing south winds in Nebraska in the spring and summer, so by planting the crop north of that, we took advantage of that to test that system. In May of each year, then for a period of every 2 to 4 weeks, we planted leafy greens in each of these plots, so that we would have leaf growth throughout the whole sampling season from June to mid-September. We fenced these plots with 7-foot panels to keep the deer out, and then we used poultry netting along the bottom to keep the rabbits out. And we used overhead irrigation to simulate what's typical industry practice. And we sampled that water for E. coli 157H7 throughout the 2 project years, and it was always negative for the pathogen. To assess environmental conditions, we collected data continuously by an on-site weather station. And we also, throughout the project season, periodically evaluated the feedlot surface conditions in terms of either how dusty they were or how muddy they were. And we also had full access to the feedlot's working schedule, so we could use that information to determine how it impacted the data that we collected. So in 2011, we planted spinach, and we found that it got really hot in July and August, that spinach did not germinate and grow very well. So in 2012, we also planted turnips and mustard greens to use for leafy greens. And so six times in each year, every 2 to 3 weeks from June to mid-September, we collected 30 leafy green samples from each of those 9 plots. And then at the very same time, we also collected 10 manure samples from each of the 10 feedlot pens that were most adjacent to our field that contained our leafy greens. And we determined the presence of E. coli 0157H7 in each of those samples. What this shows is a summary of those data. And what you're looking at is the percentage of E. coli 0157H7 positive samples amongst our feedlot manure samples that we collected from the feedlot pens, and amongst the leafy green samples that we collected at 200 and 400 and 600 feet from the edge of that feedlot. The presence of the pathogen was real high in both years, and it was an average of 72.5% positive for E. coli 0157H7 in each year. And we also found the pathogen in leafy greens. We found it at low rates, but we found it at all the distances that we tested, including 600 feet. If you consider both years together, it was 3.5% of samples of leafy greens positive for E. coli 0157H7 at 200 feet. And that was different than the 1.8% of positive samples that we saw at 600 feet. Now, this is the same slide, but it's showing the two, I've highlighted the two different years here so you can kind of compare them. In 2011, 1.5% of samples that we collected at 200 feet were positive for E. coli 0157, and that wasn't different than the 0.4 at 400 feet or the 0.8% at 600 feet. But you'll notice if you compare this 2011 data, 2012, that the recovery of the pathogen was higher in 2012. 5.6% of the leafy greens that we collected at 200 feet were positive for E. coli 0157, and it was significantly different than the 2.8 at 600 feet, that of the 2.8 at 600 feet, suggesting that the prevalence of the pathogen leafy greens did decrease as we increased the distance from the feedlot. One of the primary reasons that we had differences in 2011 and 2012 were our weather conditions and our subsequent environmental conditions. Now, in 2012, we had experienced extreme drought conditions. We only had 12.2 inches of rain during our from May to September during the project season in 2012, compared to the 17.4 that we saw in 2011. In 2012, the mean temperature was 71.7 degrees Fahrenheit, which was 3 degrees higher than what we saw in 2011. And that isn't a lot of difference in temperature, but what is different is that there were nearly twice as many days in 2012 that we had temperatures that were 90 degrees or higher. The predominant wind direction was similar in each year, as were the number of days that we had high wind speeds of 25 miles an hour or greater. And what this is showing is all of the data from each of our different sampling times in 2012, that year when the recovery of E. coli 0157H7 was higher. And if you look across at nearly any of these particular time points, you see that the general trend is for decrease in E. coli 0157H7 leafy greens as we move away from the feedlot. And it was most typical to not find the pathogen in leafy greens at 600 feet. But what I want to call your attention to is this last sampling day. On this day, we found 6.4% of leafy green samples positive for E. coli 0157H7, 12.2 at 400, and 15.5 at 600 feet. And it's this overall higher recovery of the pathogen on this day that drives the overall higher percentages in 2012. And of course, makes you wonder what was going on this particular day. So these higher numbers, higher recovery of E. coli 0157H7 on that sampling day was due to a large rearrangement of cattle at the feedlot during what was a very dry and dusty period. We sampled on September 10th, and then, but a few days before that, on September 6th and 7th, 300 head of cattle had moved out of those 10 feedlot pens adjacent to our lot, And these were replaced with another 300 head of cattle. In the 2 weeks before we'd sampled, we'd had very little rain, only about, you know, 200 inches of rain, and the average high temperature was very high, making for a very, you know, dusty, dry feedlot surface. And the winds were predominantly from the south and southwest, and they were pretty breezy. So, you know, what happened was is that there was a lot of dust generated. Those southerly winds, you know, blew that off of the feedlot out into the leafy green crop. To determine the airborne transport of E. coli 0157H7, we collected air samples, always when the wind was from out of the south, along several occasions in each project season, but always at the edge of the feedlot in each leafy green crop each time we sampled. And we determined both E. coli 0157H7 and total E. coli. In either year, we did not recover E. coli 0157H7 in air samples. Using this particular air sampling procedure, it just wasn't sensitive enough. But what we did find in both years was that we found total E. coli in the air samples, which suggests that, you know, the transport of the pathogenic strain also occurs. Don't try to read any of this. What I'm going to do is just point out a few things for you. What you're looking at is all of our air sampling data from the 2012 project season, and it's showing you viable cells per 1,000 liters of air at each right at the edge of the feedlot, and then at 200 and 400 and 600 feet at each of our leafy green pots. Now, I'll highlight these data first. One of our goals was to air sample under a variety of environmental conditions to see what impacted this. And these samples that were collected on these 2 days were collected under similar environmental conditions, except for on one of the days, the feedlot surface was moderately dusty, and then on the other day, it was moderately muddy. But for both samplings, the recovery of E. coli 0157H7, or rather the total E. coli in the air samplers were similar, suggesting that airborne transport of the pathogen isn't, you know, restricted completely just to dry, dusty conditions. On this day, July 25th, we detected minimal E. coli in air. What had happened a few days before this is all of the cattle were moved out of those 10 feedlot pens. All of the manure was scraped off, and then these were replaced with new cattle. So when that feedlot manure, the source material, was, you know, substantially gone, we detected minimal E. coli in the air. And on August 24th, we detected, you know, on this particular day, we detected more total E. coli in the air samples, you know, again, than we did at any other air sampling time, which of course makes you wonder what was going on that day as well. On August 24th, when we air sampled, there had been a substantial, you know, more cattle activity in the pens than what was normal. The cattle that had been put in these pens were very curious about our, you know, they hadn't been in the pens there very long, so they were still very curious about some of our air sampling activities. And it had also been very hot in the several days prior to that on August 24th. Very little rain, only about 600 inches of rain. We had pretty high temperatures. On the day we sampled, it was much lower than it had been in several days. The high that day was only about 75 degrees. So the cattle, between being very curious about what we were doing, and they were also feeling very frisky since it was cooler, you know, ran down to the edge of the fences where we were to see what we were doing. And it kicked up a lot of dust, kicking up their heels and running and butting, and it increased our detection of E. coli in the air samples. Is there a role for transmitting that flies have in transmitting pathogens to produce? And Astrid Wade-Donnie is going to talk next, and she's going to tell you about that more. We already know that, you know, we knew this before, and then we've heard a lot about this morning, that livestock manure is a real important, you know, breeding site and feeding site for flies. And we also know that flies can, you know, pick up pathogens from manure and then subsequently, you know, take them to other places and leave them on other surfaces, including to other animals in a production environment. Many pest fly species also spend a good part of their day or their nights resting in vegetation, and some pest fly species will visit plants because they're attracted to the nectar or the pollen or to honeydew that's secreted by other insects. So, you know, if a fly has been sitting on manure, picks up the pathogen, goes to rest in vegetation, that vegetation is a leafy green, then certainly the opportunity is there. Yeah, you know, we explored this by trapping flies with yellow sticky traps that we put at the edge of the feedlot and then at each of our three plot distances of 200 and 400 and 600 feet. after we'd set them out for a fixed period of time, we brought those in, identified all the flies in the traps, then pooled them after we counted them according to their species, and then determined the presence of E. coli 0 and 5-7 in or on the flies. We didn't distinguish between whether it was in or on. We took them and squashed them all. Anyway, what we found was E. coli 0 and 5-7-H7, you know, occurred at pretty high percentages in pest flies that we found, you know, near the feedlots. We found 18.7% of fly pools positive for E. coli 0 and 5-7-H7 at the edge of the feedlot. That was significantly higher than the 10.7, 9, and 10.2% of fly pools that we found at 200, 400, and 600 feet, which didn't differ by distance. We also, you know, analyzed this data according to estimated E. coli 0 and 5-7-H7 infection rates of pest flies that we collected at the different distances, and it mirrored that of what we saw with the percentages of pathogen positive fly pools. That's lots of P's there. What was most interesting was what the differences were between the different species of the pest flies, which suggests that different species differ in their risk for carrying E. coli 0 and 5-7-H7. House flies and face flies, you know, had the highest percentage of those fly pools of those species had the highest percentages of E. coli 0 and 5-7-H7 at 17.1% positive and 15.7% positive. And in contrast, with stable flies, only one fly pool out of 159 fly pools of stable flies we looked at was positive for E. coli 0 and 5-7-H7. And of course, this is a reflection of the different lifestyles of these particular flies. Fresh manure, we've heard already, is important to house flies. They don't feed on it. It's important to face flies. They like to lay their eggs in it. Where stable flies, on the other hand, you know, they're much less interested in the fresh manure. They want to go lay their eggs in old manure mixed with vegetation. And they're a biting fly, and they feed on blood rather than manure. All of the E. coli 0 and 5-7-H7 isolates that we got from the leafy greens, from the flies, from the feedlot manure samples were analyzed by pulse field gel electrophoresis. This is a DNA fingerprinting method that we can use to fingerprint the isolates and distinguish unique isolates amongst the group, and perhaps provide linkages to the different sample types. And in both of the years, you know, the pulse field types that we found in the leafy green samples were also the predominant types that we found in the feedlot manure and also the ones that we found in the flies. So just kind of wrap up, to recap a little bit, the occurrence of E. coli 0 and 5-7-H7, we found it can be transported from a cattle feedlot out into leafy greens. With the leafy green sample, we found that the prevalence of the pathogen in leafy greens does decrease as you move away from the feedlot. We saw a similar thing with total E. coli in the air samples. What does this mean for produce source? The maximum distance that we tested was 600 feet. At that distance, we found E. coli 0 and 5-7-H7 positive leafy greens. We found total E. coli positive air samples. And we also found the pathogens in flies. So this suggests that the current guidelines of 400 feet to place in between leafy greens and the concentrated animal feeding operation may not be adequate to reduce the risk of produce contamination. Further work is going to be needed, though, since we didn't go past that 600 feet to determine more appropriate distances for buffer zones. We also found that the risk for transporting E. coli 0 and 5-7-H7 to the feedlot surface is increased when you have dry, dusty feedlot surfaces and you have cattle management activities that generate a lot of airborne dust. And furthermore, cattle pest flies will carry E. coli 0 and 5-7-H7, and finding the same molecular types in the flies, as well as the manure and the flies and the leafy greens, indicates that all these things are potential sources of contamination. We didn't, provide any evidence that one is more important than the other, but with a long-term detailed study like this, it does provide some information that can inform future studies about it. And to our knowledge, this is the first report of the carriage of this pathogen by either face flies or sarcophagin flies. And I know I can't say everybody's name individually, but it was a big study, and it took a lot of hard work and talent and expertise of a whole lot of people to get it accomplished. And I'd also like to mention that this work was funded in part by the Center for Produce Safety. And I don't know if I have time for, do I have time for a question? Can I do a question? Or we can say we want to do it too. Thank you. Yes.
And so if I understood correctly, you always had the 200, 400, 600 plots planted at the same time, right?
Yes.
So do you think there might have been an effect of a leading edge of that yield, whether it was at 200 or 400? In other words, if you hadn't had the 200 and 400 and the first field was 600, would you have seen different results?
You know, we consider that when we laid them out, but, you know, the wind always wasn't straight out of the south. And, you know, by putting anything in that field there, which also had burned grass and other things in it, you know, may have affected the flow of things. But since sometimes the wind was coming from the southeast or coming from the southwest, we went ahead and lined them up the way you see the picture there, and don't think it probably impacted it very much.
You might consider that if you're looking at that longest distance, especially if flies are the carrier, because I would expect a leading edge
associated with flies. You mean like if they sat at 200 feet, they might not move on to 600 feet?
Right, they may stop at the first field, whatever distance that first field is. I'm not sure how wind moves that way.
Right. I can talk to you more about that. I have an idea. Find me afterwards if you have more questions.